The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Club W. Club W is offering our audience members who are 21 and over and who live in the U.S. a $20 credit on their first order of 3 bottles of wine as a new member of Club W. So go to clubw.com/Jim. That's clubw.com/Jim and get $20 off your first order when you become a new member. Thanks, Club W. The Paranormal Podcast is also brought to you by Scott Evest. Whether you're a ghost hunter or a gadget guy or girl, tons of pockets in your clothing, well, they just make everything better. Also, they're great gifts. To learn more and get a super special Scott Evest deal, go to jimherald.com/vest. That's jimherald.com/vest. Thanks, Scott Evest.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you today. Dealing with a little bit of a cold, so my voice is a little raspy, but we're still here and we have some great interviews for you. First, I wanted to tell you about something very, very cool. I am so excited about it. If we have any adult coloring book fans out there, it was a new thing to me too, if you've not heard of it. But apparently, this is a huge craze. People love to do adult coloring books. So I thought, what a great thing to team with my campfire podcast. We have so many great stories and mental images. So I teamed with a great artist by the name of Len Peralta, and we created a true ghost story adult coloring book inspired by Jim Harold's Campfire. You can get it now at Amazon.com, Amazon.co.uk. If you want to get those links really easily, you can just go to JimHaroldBooks.com and go directly to the coloring book. And so far, rave reviews. Last week when it first came out, we were the number one new release in Ghost and Hauntings. We already have several five-star reviews up there, so it seems to be hitting a nerve. And I hope that you will buy it. Enjoy it. Share it with your adult coloring friends if you're so inclined. And also, please rate and review it on Amazon if you like it. So there you have it. I hope you'll check out this true ghost story adult coloring book. Today, we've got a big double header for you. We've got Guy Lyon Playfair, who, of course, you know from the Enfield Poltergeist. He has some interesting comments about Ed and Lorraine Warren, and I'll leave it at that. And then we've got Dr. Robert Davis joining us, and he is going to talk to us about all things UFO and some very interesting research he's doing. And now on to the Paranormal Podcast. We really have a legendary figure on the line, a great writer on the paranormal who has been involved in some of the biggest cases, and we're so thrilled to have him on the program. I'm talking about Guy Lyon Playfair, and of course, he is mostly associated, maybe best known for his work on the Enfield Poltergeist, and we're certainly going to talk about that and other cases, but really just a storied career, a big figure, and we're so happy to have him with us today. Mr. Playfair, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So as I understand it, if I've done my research correctly, you started in the field of journalism and you got involved in this field, if I'm correct. Can you tell us kind of how that all took place?
Well, it started when I was living in Brazil, working as a freelance writer and also a photographer, and I needed a regular job, so I was offered a post with the American Embassy in the USAID press section, which was quite a contrast to chasing after poltergeists. So I took that and I stayed there for 4 years, and when they abolished the post, I was out of a job and with a very generous handshake. So I decided to stay on, and I stayed for a total of 14 years. I joined a research group in São Paulo, eventually, led by Brazil's leading parapsychologist, Hernani Andrade, who was an absolutely marvelous teacher and guide and colleague. And He was a big specialist in field research. He liked actually dealing with real live cases of poltergeists or reincarnation or mediums or psychic surgeons or whatever. A complete contrast to the kind of academic specialist who never gets out of his office and knows all the answers. So I had a very good training with Andrade for 2 years of intensive theory and practice, and I owe him absolutely everything that I ever learned about psychical research.
Now, coming from a journalistic background and a very fact-based, you know, kind of just the facts, ma'am, who, what, when, where, if I remember correctly from my college journalism studies, how did you make that leap? Because, you know, people might consider this field of research a bit out there, and the thought is that it is not fact-based. I'm not saying that, but that's the thought among many. How did you make that kind of intellectual leap?
Well, no, it was much more straightforward than that, because one thing I used to do was every day I would go out and buy the popular press, or what you might call the gutter press. I mean, you know, really sort of bottom of the heap.
Tabloids,
I assume. Well, they had a curious habit in Brazil. They would report spontaneous cases, even road accidents or fires or whatever. They would give much more coverage than you'd ever find in a European or probably American newspaper. And they would always give the name and address of the people involved, and they would frequently cover poltergeists. That seemed to be a big favorite. So all I had to do was to look at the address and go there. And it didn't matter if they got it all wrong. In fact, they tended to be fairly accurate. You know, if somebody had a house infested by a poltergeist, and I got there on the same day and found that it was still going on, I reckon that the paper was telling the truth. So that's how I got into the kind of other world, if you like. It was rather different from writing about hydroelectric dams, which I'd been doing for the USAID for 4 years, and I was a bit tired of hydroelectric dams, frankly. And I found poltergeists a lot more interesting.
And it is a fascinating topic. And when you talk about poltergeist, one of the most famous, and we're going to talk a little bit about this because of the current movie that's out, Conjuring 2, really enjoyed Conjuring 1 as a piece of entertainment. I don't know how factual it was, but I enjoyed it as a piece of entertainment. But the Enfield poltergeist, being one of the chief investigators on that, as I believe you were, and of course documenting it in your very famous book, This House is Haunted. How did you get involved in that case?
Well, it was a series of coincidences. I was attending a lecture at the Society for Psychical Research, or the SPR, which I've been a member since 1973. And in 1976, I went along to the lecture, which just happened to be on poltergeists. And it was very good. It was very sort of academic and correct and well-researched and so on. And I found it very interesting. And then at the end of the talk, at question time, a fellow who was sitting right behind me jumped up and said he was investigating a case right now. And it was a very good one, and he would like some help. And that was a fellow named Maurice Gross, who was a new member. He'd only just joined. And I hardly knew him. I just sort of said, hello, you know, I've seen a familiar face at previous meetings. But he certainly wasn't a friend of mine, and I didn't know anything about him. And I didn't offer to help because I was hoping to go on holiday. I'd just finished a very long book, which was quite exhausting, and I'd already decided to just clear off for a month or so and recover. But then Maurice Gross turned up on the radio a couple of days later. The BBC had got hold of the story, and they were in the so-called haunted house. And it sounded pretty genuine to me. I mean, I'd already investigated a few poltergeists in Brazil, and so I knew roughly what to look for. And it just sounded right. So I got hold of Maurice and said, oh, well, all right, I'll look in once or twice and then hopefully go off on holiday. So I looked in and I stayed there for 14 months and I never got the holiday. That's how it started.
What do you think, or what do you know? I mean, you were there. What made that such a seminal case, such a case that's kind of stood out among all the others?
Well, I think, modesty apart, the fact is that Maurice and I were there right at the start, and we stayed on it right until the end. And that's never been done before, and certainly not for 14 months. And we also made free use of cassette recorders. We had one each, and we virtually kept the recorder on all the time we were in the house every day. I've now got about 200 hours of cassette recordings, including a lot of live action. And they are tremendously valuable because when I play them back today, I remember things that I'd completely forgotten about. I think, gosh, was that me? And it sounded like me, so it must have been. But if I hadn't had the tape, I think there's a lot that I would have forgotten. So that must be an absolute golden rule now that tapes are a great deal cheaper. They were very expensive in the 70s. We spent a fortune on cassettes. And you really do have to record everything on a case like this because there's a well-known tendency when you wake up the next day, you think, gosh, that can't have happened. And you tend to forget about it. You tend to reject things that you can't explain.
Now, I have to ask about this because we have this new movie out, Conjuring 2. And as I said, I really enjoyed Conjuring 1 and actually had one of the family members from that on. Perrone, I believe, is her name. I'm drawing a blank here. But in terms of Conjuring 2, now, in terms of a piece of entertainment, I haven't had a chance to see it yet. I'm sure it's fun entertainment, as the first one was. But in terms of some of the, quote, facts that are presented in this movie, I know much has been made about the role of Ed and Lorraine Warren. Obviously, they as characters were in the first movie. And it seems as though, from what I read, you may feel that their involvement is quite a bit overstated in terms of this current movie.
That's putting it very diplomatically, yes. Well, Ed Warren has passed away, so he can't sue me for libel. But Lorraine is still alive, so I won't say anything about her. I hardly met her anyway, and she seemed to be quite a harmless lady. And Ed Warren, I frankly did not like. I didn't agree with his sort of obsession with devils and demons and so on. It just turned me completely off. And when he turned up uninvited at Enfield, I kind of made my excuses and got out of the way and left. And I never saw him again. And I've since heard Conjuring 2 is full of all kinds of fantastic nonsense that never happened. And He was just one more visitor that we had all the time. That people kept dropping in and hoping to see some action. And when they hadn't seen anything happening in half an hour, they concluded it was all a fake and went away. And we learned to ignore these people. And the Warrens were just two more. And I didn't really take much notice of them.
So obviously it seems like Hollywood once again has, according to your take on it and your experience having been there, they've probably taken quite a bit of creative license with what really happened.
Yes.
And do you find that to be the case? I'm curious, because the thing that I think that when you go in and watch one of these movies, like even if you're talking about something back in the 70s, Amityville Horror, or obviously The Exorcist had its basis in a real case, although I believe it was a boy instead of a girl, and there are a lot of things. Do you have to take all of this with a huge grain of salt when you go to see these movies based on a true story?
Well, I don't go to see films of that type. I've only ever seen two, I think, that I would want to see again. One, of course, was The Shining, a Kubrick masterpiece, which is just a great film. I don't know, it's probably not true to life at all, but that doesn't matter. And the other one was the wonderful film that Jack Cardiff made of the Henry James's story, The Turn of the Screw, a film called The Innocents, which was just so well made that you can't stop watching it. And again, whether it's true to life or not, really doesn't matter. It didn't claim to be true to life. But what rather annoyed me about the Conjuring and also the television series that came out the year before called The Enfield Haunting is that they did claim to be what they call based on the book. And they may have been based on it. I mean, like a moon rocket is based on Cape Canaveral, you know, by the time you get to the moon. The moon is not Florida, is it? And the same thing happened with... I did see the television series, which, frankly, I had quite difficulty in recognizing it, although one of the characters was actually portraying me, which is very flattering, but it had very little connection with what really happened at all. But the good news is that it sold a lot of books. Sold, I think, more books in the week following the TV show than I'd sold in the previous 20 years. So that was nice. And it's all happening again now with this film, The Conjurer, which I haven't seen and don't intend to see. So so long as the money keeps rolling in, I'm not worried.
Well, there's a lot more I want to talk about maybe the nature of poltergeists and your thoughts on that. Also, the work that you've done on twin telepathy, all fascinating topics, fascinating guest, Guy Lyon Playfair. We'll be back right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Club W. Club W is offering our audience members who are 21 and over and who live in the U.S. a $20 credit on their first order of 3 bottles of wine as a new member of Club W. I love Club W. I am getting into wine, and I never thought that would happen. I've told the story before, you know, when I first started out working in radio and worked for this classical music station and see all these important people clinking their wine glasses and kind of swirling around saying, oh, it's got good legs. I thought, wow, this is way beyond me. But Club W has changed that. I look forward to my monthly shipment. I look forward to the education process and learning about the wines. And just, I'm getting into it. I'm becoming a wine connoisseur. And anybody who knew me would never think that's possible. But it's all because of Club W, because they have a new way of becoming a wine fan. Club W is really serving a new generation of wine drinkers like me, want to do away with all that pretense and simply enjoy reasonably priced great wine. The Club W custom tailors wines to the taste of the individual consumer and delivers 3 bottles of wine each month to your doorstep for $39 plus a flat $9 shipping rate. Now, the way you start out is this. You visit Club W, you take their 20-second palate profile quiz to get instant wine recommendations on things that you like. They're not asking about your taste in wine. They talk about your general taste, what kind of food you like, and so forth. And then they come up and say, Jim would like these wines, we think. Of course, you can go off of that and choose whatever you want and become more adventurous, but they give you some guidance. Now, the price point for most wines is $20. So by signing up with Club W through this offer I'm going to give you, you're getting your first bottle for free. So Club W is offering our audience members who are 21 and over and who live in the U.S. a $20 credit on their first order of 3 bottles of wine as a new member of Club W. I love it. It is such a great, great thing. I just got my shipment the other day and looking forward to delving into that. So to receive your $20 credit on your first order, go to clubw.com/Jim. That's clubw.com/Jim. Thanks, Club W. Welcome back to the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest today is author Guy Leon Playfair. And of course, you know him from his work on many different cases and many different books, but most notably, I think, or best known, the Enfield Poltergeist. And on the question of poltergeists, it's interesting to me the possible explanations for these things. I had several years ago on the program Michael Clarkson, a Canadian journalist who I believe was even at one point nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. So a hardcore journalist who had looked at this in his book, The Poltergeist Phenomenon, and he came to the conclusion he definitely thought something was going on, that there was reality to this. He talked to law enforcement officers and people of what you would think would be good credibility, and he come to the conclusion, who had seen these sorts of things, come to the conclusion there's definitely something going on. He tended, if I recall correctly, to think that maybe it's energy given off by adolescence, and I've heard that theory before, that kind of thing. Young people, can affect these things totally unintentionally. It's not a hoax, but it's just something about them and their energy. Have you come to any conclusions or theories as to what is going on with poltergeists after you rule out things like hoaxes and so forth?
Well, if I'd figured it out, I think I'd have a Nobel Prize. It's completely mysterious. All we have, the only progress that we have made in recent years is that we are collecting clues. One particularly important one, which I was involved in, was in managing to tape record these very loud thumps on the floor, which sound as if somebody was stamping their feet with nailed boots on. And I heard those on one of my cases in Brazil. And it occurred to me that I was going to make some thumps myself and then run them through an oscilloscope and see if they look the same. And so I recorded a lot of thumping by me and my research partner, Suzuku, who was another member of the institute that I was working with. And they sounded exactly the same. You couldn't really tell them apart. But when you play them back on this machine, this oscilloscope, which shows the acoustic pattern, they are completely different. You just simply cannot mistake one for the other. So to cut a long story short, but when I was back in England and a member of the Society for Psychical Research, a colleague of mine, Barry Colvin, who owns a chemical factory, and he's got all the necessary gear. He had one of these machines, and he's also a very keen poltergeist hunter. And between us, we put together a collection of about 12 recordings from 3 to 4 different countries of thumps on poltergeist cases, and they all show the same pattern. So I think that is what scientists like to call a series instead of just a succession of anomalous incidents. So I think we've got a very genuine database there. And the fact is that you can't imitate this. You know, all these clever magicians who say that they know how all these things are done, well, they don't. And the only similar acoustic pattern to the noises made by a poltergeist are those that you get from an earthquake. Now, that's very interesting because numerous investigators of poltergeists have commented on how the noise seems to come from inside the wall or inside the floorboards, you know, not on the surface. And also, I noticed that nothing ever vibrates. When you get a deafening bang on the floor in a house full of glasses and ornaments and things, there's absolutely no echo, no vibration mm-hmm. at all. Whereas, of course, if you do it, when I do it with the broomstick on the floor, the whole house shakes. So that is a very important clue, and it's been completely ignored. It was published in 2011, that's 5 years ago, in the Journal of the SPR, and we sent out news releases to about 30 to 35 outlets, and it was only mentioned by two of them, and very briefly, and they happened to be papers where I had friends, so that's pretty pathetic. See, complain that we don't have any evidence. When we do have evidence, they won't look at it.
You know, that's an interesting point, because, for example, if I look at television, quote, journalism, but many times, you know, if there's somebody who is in their backyard, or they're in their, and they think they see Bigfoot, or they're in their house and they claim that there's a little mist and they see a ghost, that's much more likely to get picked up by the tabloids and the television stations than something that is a serious study, because I think it's much the same thing. These people want quick hits. They want superficial things. They want things that will get page views on the internet. They're not interested, much like entertainment is not interested in getting into the real meat of the matter. I think that, quote, journalism and news is not interested in it either. They either want to make a joke of it or have something that's titillating.
Well, there is another rather more serious aspect to this, which I think the reason for this sort of strange reaction is based on fear. You know, people really cannot face the thought that it might be true. So why not convert it into a sort of comedy show where it's all fantasy and it's sort of Disneyland and it's make-believe and so on. And, you know, folklore is absolutely full of stories of haunted houses and Baroque castles and witches and monsters and so on. But if somebody comes along and says, yeah, actually this is happening right around the corner, there is an immediate panic reaction. You know, we just can't face it. I think that is the secret to the extreme anger and sort of really quite nasty retribution that we get from people who call themselves skeptics, although they're anything but skeptical. It's simply based on fear, you know. It was summed up very nicely in the 19th century in the humorous magazine called Punch, which was very popular at the time. It was a cartoon of two very smart ladies praying in a church, and one of them says, "Oh dear God, please tell us that Mr. Darwin was wrong." And the other one says, "Yes, and if he's right, please help us cover it up." And I think they struck on a very true chord there, because it's the same problem is going on today. I've often had sort of dinner party experiences, you know, where I happen to mention poltergeist, and there's always a sort of hushed silence, and everybody has another drink and laughs and sort of ha ha, and they can't really take the idea that I might be telling the truth. So I tend not to do it these days, but it's I think that's where you find the explanation to this attitude.
Do you have any hope that the worm will turn? I mean, that people will start looking at something like the Society of Psychical Research and looking at that instead of maybe looking at some of the sensational television shows or more some of the more sensational books. Do you think that will ever happen, or are we kind of doomed to this loop of entertainment?
Well, it just struck me recently that we're just about celebrating the 500th anniversary of the first mention of the word poltergeist in print, which was in one of Martin Luther's tracts that he banged out in the early 16th century. And he mentions the word poltergeist as if everybody knew what he meant. He didn't define it anywhere. So it was probably actually invented before printing. which had only been invented in 1480-something. And Luther kept banging on about poltergeists all the time. He was quite obsessed by them. And, of course, it was all very straightforward then. It was an evil spirit, or emissary of the devil, and so on. And that sort of attitude still prevails, which is quite extraordinary. So I don't think that's going to change. But the good news is that we are getting a lot more support from scientists than we used to. I mean, we have at least one Nobel Prize winner who's a member of the SPR, who's extremely supportive and frequently defends things like poltergeists and so on in public. And, of course, he gets a lot more attention than people who don't have Nobel Prizes. So that's very nice. And also, on the council of the SPR, which I'm happy to belong to, we have no less than 5 university professors, heads of departments, including 2 physicists. And there is genuine interest in this sort of field of quantum studies and all that strange stuff. They're quite happy with psychic phenomena. There's no problem at all. So that is changing very much. I mean, materialism has been found to be a bit of an illusion. I mean, there's no such thing as matter when you look at it closely. It's all energy. And that is a change, but it'll take an awful lot of time to sink into the general public, I'm afraid. They want devils and demons are much more easier to understand.
Before we talk a little bit about twin telepathy, I do want to ask you one last question. I mean, obviously, you had this long-standing investigation of the Enfield poltergeist. Is there one example of something that happened there that kind of haunts you to this day that still amazes you? Or I'm sure maybe there are many things, but is there one that you could point out and share with us that really has stuck with you over the decades?
No, I'm afraid not. I think there were about 500 of them. One of the most interesting was actually the first thing that happened in the house. You know, like so many things, the first one is quite often the best. And the first night I went there, I was presented with a simple glass marble, which landed on the linoleum floor right in front of me with a loud bang. And it was as if somebody had sort of held it and put it on the floor in the hand, because it didn't roll, it didn't bounce or roll. And you simply cannot do that. If you drop a marble, even from a few inches, it's going to bounce and it's going to roll around and end up on the other side of the room. And this one just came down, bang, and it stayed exactly where it hit the floor. And when you think about it, you can't do that. So from then on, it became an absolute rule of Maurice Gross and myself. When something peculiar happened, we immediately tried to do it ourselves. And sometimes we could, and very often we couldn't. So I think that, in a way, is very persuasive evidence. There are things that just can't be faked.
I do want to talk to you about this idea of twin telepathy, even though I know our time is growing short, but just a little bit. I mean, what got you interested in this? Because this idea that twins have this invisible bond is just always fascinated me. How did you get interested in it?
Well, I'd always been interested in it because I'd read quite a lot about psychical research in general, and it kept on turning up. And then in 1976, I think it was, there was a very high-profile murder of a twin called Ross McWhirter, who was one of the editors of the Guinness Book of Records. And he was shot by an IRA terrorist outside his own house. And it immediately struck me, well, if there's any truth in this stuff about twins picking up their twins' experiences, this ought to be a pretty good test. It's not the kind of thing you can do in a laboratory, but it's happened. So I tried to check that up, and I managed to get through to to Ross's brother, Norris McWhirter, who, as it happened, I knew somebody who worked for him and knew him quite well. And he didn't mind talking about his brother. So I had him ask, did he feel anything at the time? And the answer was no. So I thought, well, that's that. And I forgot about it. And then 20 years later, at least 20 years later, I happened to meet his son. That is to say, the nephew of the man who was murdered and the son of his twin brother. And in the course of conversation, he was also very, very sort of straightforward about it all. He said, yes, he did react very much because he was there. The son was with him. And they were just waiting to go out to the school play. And his father suddenly clutched his chest and slumped into a chair. And his son thought he'd had a heart attack and screamed for his mother, who came down. At that moment, the police turned up and said that they wanted him to come along and identify his brother's body. So that was kind of evidence you really can't ignore. It's absolutely first-hand evidence right in front of my face. So I thought, damn, this needs investigation, and I'm still at it.
What are some of the theories as to what is at play here? Because to me, it seems almost irrefutable that there is something going on. There's just so many reports. I know so many people say, ah, that's anecdotal. But that means it's actually happening to me. What are some of the theories and perhaps some of your favorite theories about what might be at play here with twin telepathy?
There are some quite interesting theories. They're all pretty complicated, and they're all rather based on what's known as non-locality,
right,
which you also find in quantum physics on the very microscopic scale. And I've just actually written an article, I'm still writing it, on monozygotic twins as a macro-entangled system, which sounds a bit pretentious, but that is actually what I believe, that entanglement has always been thought only to apply to the microscopic level. In fact, a quantum, so-called quantum leap is the smallest leap you can possibly take. It's in the sort of thousandths of microns. But it's a kind of analogy. The same thing does happen to about one-third of identical twins, not all of them by any means. Many twins, including some that I know quite well, never had any trace of telepathy throughout their lives, and others have it quite often. And it looks to me as though it has to do with the exact timing of the division of the original zygote egg after fertilization, because that is the only variable that I can think of to account for very considerable differences, because just as George Orwell said that some animals were more equal than others in Animal Farm, I'm saying that some identical twins are more identical than others. That's true. They really are.
That has always fascinated me, that particular topic. What are you most excited about these days that you're working on? Twin telepathy or more poltergeist involved
things?
What's your favorite these days?
Twins. No more poltergeist, please. I've had enough of them. Twins, at least, are sort of relatively normal, although some of them are a bit funny, but they're much easier to deal with. And quite a lot of them become good friends as well. So I definitely stick with twins. And also, there is real important scientific knowledge to be extracted from them. And luckily, I've managed to meet some who are very cooperative and just as interested as I am in investigating themselves. So I definitely intend to stay with that until I collect my Nobel Prize, and then I'll move on to something else.
Very good. And the thing is that it must be a lot easier investigating twins who are here than maybe ghosts or something else that may be not interested in being found out necessarily.
Yeah, well, twins can be very, very elusive. I mean, there is a certain sort of Cosa Nostra thing about some twins. Well, even with twins that I know quite well, I sometimes get the impression that, you know, hey, this is very private and we don't really want to talk about it. And you do have to handle them very, very carefully and tactfully. And I've found it's always best to wait for them to raise the subject, which they do if they think they've got a sympathetic audience. But you do have to be you have to handle them very, very carefully indeed. Some of them, they're the best of the lot are young children. They're absolutely marvelous because they haven't been told that it's impossible. You see, so they just tell it the way it is, and also the mothers of babies and small children, they're my best informers, because they obviously keep a very close eye on their babies, like all mothers do, and they know more about them than the children themselves. And I think I've got really practically all my best evidence from mothers, sometimes of babies who have only just been born, and they demonstrate dramatic contact at a distance. So, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt at all that there is an effect there, and it's quite hard to tease it out from the cases where there is no telepathy, and it's hard to work out why some twins are so unlike others. But we are making good progress in that, and I've got some very erudite colleagues who are helping on that, so I think that's looks very promising indeed. But it is a real effect, definitely, yes.
Well, it's been a great conversation. I've really appreciated your time today. Where can people find out more information, find your books? Because certainly there's a wealth of things to check out there.
Well, that's quite easy, I'm glad to say. They're all available from Amazon. If you're in the United States, I think it's Amazon.com.
Correct.
And in England, it's Amazon.co.uk. Or I guess it's the same anywhere else. And that's where to get it. And I may say that it's the only book anyone's ever written about twin telepathy. So if you're interested, that's the one you have to have.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Well, we thank you for your time today. It's been a fascinating discussion, and we can hope that you're able to continue from success to success in your research and your writing.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
That was a compelling and fascinating discussion with Guy Lyon Playfair. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you did as well. Next up is Dr. Robert Davis. We're going to be talking about UFO and ET research right after this message on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Scott Evest. Whether you're a ghost hunter or a gadget guy like me, tons of pockets in your clothing just make everything better. And I'm going to tell you about the power of pockets. Now, I want to be clear on this. Scott Evest has a great selection of jackets and vests and various clothing with a ton of pockets in them. It's all very high quality stuff. And most people associate with guys, but it's not just for guys. For example, my daughter is going to be a high school senior this year. And we were looking at the Scott Evest site, and I said, you really ought to consider this. And she got excited about it, and she picked out the Annie, which is a jacket for women. And she just got it the other day and loves it. It's got 35 pockets. You can carry all kinds of stuff in it. It's really great, and I absolutely love it. It's got the situation where you can wire your headphones in. You can carry a medium-sized tablet, whether that's an iOS tablet, like an iPad or a mini, or maybe an Android tablet, for your glasses, for pens, for a water bottle, keys, the headphone pre-wiring I think I mentioned. There's so many other things that you can do with these vests and these jackets. It's incredible. I have several of theirs. I have the Quest Vest, which has 42 pockets. They have a summertime vest that I have that I enjoy very much this kind of time of year. And I love that too. I just gotta say, Scott E. Vest, I mean, we have so many Scott E. Vest in our house that it's like, we're running out of rack space because I absolutely love Scott E. Vest. I wear them. I have their feather white vest is the one I have for summer, and Quest Vest. I have their system, 8.0, which includes an outer shell jacket and an inner shell jacket. And you could take those apart and wear them separately or together. I just love Scott E. Vest. Couldn't recommend it highly enough. And I know our listeners are enjoying it. I had one listener around holiday time say, hey, I got this for my parents, mom and dad. They loved it. And they thought it was so unique because it's just something, you know, you just don't find everywhere. It's totally unique. I'm going to tell you, it's a great deal. I highly recommend them. Scott E. Vest, again, carries a full line of pocket-powered clothing for both men and women, shorts, pants, shirts, jackets, even sports jackets. So I've got a deal for you. If you'd like to save 20% on your Scott E. Vest purchase, go to jimherold.com/vest. That's jimherold.com/vest. Click on the link I provide there and use the coupon code JimHerold, and you'll get 20% off your purchase. What a deal. Discover the power of the pocket. Go to jimherold.com/vest. Click on that link that I provide there and use a coupon code JimHerold, one word, and you'll get 20% off your order. Thanks, Scott E. Vest. Today, we're going to talk about the UFO phenomenon and some exciting research going on under the auspices of the Dr. Edgar Mitchell Free Foundation, of course, named after the late great astronaut, Dr. Edgar Mitchell. And we have Dr. Robert Davis with us. He is on the board of directors of the foundation. He is also a retired professor of neuroscience. He's a co-chair of the free research committee that the Mitchell Foundation is doing so much interesting work on. We're going to talk about that today. Dr. Davis is internationally recognized as a scientist in his field and served as a professor at the State University of New York for over 30 years. He has his PhD in neuroscience from The Ohio State University, and he's published over 40 articles in scholarly journals and several book chapters on various topics in clinical audiology, the area of his expertise. His research and investigation into the UFO phenomenon convinced him that the phenomenon remains unsolved, and he has been on the programs before. We're so glad to have him back. Dr. Robert Davis, welcome back to the programs.
Oh, it's a pleasure being back here again with you, Jim. Thanks.
So maybe some people haven't heard of the Dr. Edgar Mitchell Free Foundation. Explain to us what the foundation is and the inspiration for it.
Well, FREE is an acronym for the Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Encounters. And it was recently initiated, founded by Ray Hernandez, who is an attorney, Dr. Rudy Shield, astrophysicist from Harvard University, Mary Rodwell, a leading researcher in this particular area of study, Dr. Klimo, who is a leading researcher in the area of psychology and the paranormal. This foundation is essentially involved with focusing research attention on those who claim to have had close encounters, shall we say, or experience with non-human entities, either on board a UFO or not. And we have conducted extensive quantitative surveys on over 2,200 individuals. And from these 2,200 individuals, we have already collected qualitative information where they describe their responses in the surveys in considerably more detail. And we have obtained that information on approximately 780 subjects. We will then move on to the next phase, the last phase of our research, which will be conducting interviews with these individuals. So in order to be an interviewee, so to speak, you have to have finished all the three previous phases, the quantitative and the qualitative. Thus far, we have analyzed the quantitative surveys, and the results are striking. And we'll have time, of course, to review some of that now. But we're trying to, in a sense, go beyond the nuts and bolts of ufology. And personally speaking, I get a little tired and annoyed by so many of the ufologists out there today who continue to, you know, review and dissect prior retrospective incidents like the Roswell and the Rendlesham Phoenix Lights, etc. Just the other day, I listened to Stan Friedman. I have great respect for Stan. He was on a very popular show, and the foundation of their discussion was whether or not a UFO crashed in Aztec, New Mexico back in the 40s. You know, as far as I'm concerned, it's interesting at some level. We learned somewhat about that, but we're not going to understand the who, what, and whys, obviously, of this phenomenon, which is real. And if anyone in your listening audience debunks ufology, I say don't debunk. I say be skeptical. That's healthy. But hundreds of thousands, if not millions of individuals, are claiming to have encounters with non-human intelligent entities that do seem to be from physical craft of a variety of shapes and sizes. And the type of contact they have, the effects it has on their behavior or transformative aspects of their personality as a result of their contact, the kind of communication they have, the experience in general, overall, is very revealing.
Now, how do you think, what is different about this research? You talked about the quantitative versus the qualitative. For those of us out there who are not really statistically minded and didn't take a lot of stats course, as I did, and I did really well until I hit multivariate statistics, then it got me. But anyway, but for people who may not know the difference between quantitative and qualitative research, can you explain the differences and the importance of having both?
Sure. The quantitative aspect of our survey is comparable to any type of survey an individual may take, where the choices are binary, yes or no, on a scale of 1 to 5, that type of response paradigm. And we analyze that in terms of percentage of an answer, being yes, no, maybe, stronger, less positive, more positive, etc. The qualitative is more descriptive, where the individual now is going to respond to approximately 60 questions that we asked of that individual. And there is no end to the type of information that they have provided to us via SurveyMonkey. And we are now in the process of analyzing that. So we have quantitative statistics in the form, again, of percent, and we will supplement or complement that information with more of the descriptive qualitative information, which we are in the process of obtaining. And we have already collected, again, information from over 2,000 individuals who claim to have conscious recall, not from hypnotic regression or lucid dreaming, but conscious recall, which is quite unique.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting, because I think that, speaking of statistics, it seems like to me when you go into regression, you would have a lot of intervening variables, which you would not have, or at least that set of intervening variables, if you just ask them about things that they experience consciously.
That's true. There are positives and negatives associated with hypnotic regression. Prefer to have it to be conscious recall, since the scientific community more or less is turned off, shall we say, on any evidence that is generated through hypnotic regressive techniques, which need to be controlled very well in order to ensure its validity of information. So we were specific about that one important variable.
So, and I'm sure some of the things you've already mentioned, but specifically, what makes this research project so unique?
It's unique in the sense that we have such a large data sample. There have been very, very few studies done in the past that only included up to maybe 50 subjects, and who were reporting their interaction with these so-called non-humans through hypnotic recall. where, again, we are not. John Mack has also done work with over 300 individuals, again, through hypnotic regression, although much of his findings were very, very interesting, and I'm not being a critic at all of these prior research efforts. The point is, it's too few and far between. The data sample size is so extensive in our study, it does add some degree of validity to it. In fact, we are continuing with our research worldwide. We are in the process of gathering information from Germany, France, South American countries. We have plans to go worldwide with it. And we have other co-researchers in these other countries who are working collaboratively with us. And we're in different phases of this process, but in a few years, I can very easily foresee having many, many thousands of individuals added to our database. And whenever you wish, we can certainly get into some of the data that I do think your audience will find quite interesting.
Our guest is Dr. Robert Davis. He is on the board of directors of the Dr. Edgar Mitchell Free Foundation. And they have some very exciting research that's been done, a revolutionary study. We talked about the methodology and the idea of it in the first segment. And now we're going to talk about some of the things that Dr. Davis and his colleagues have found. So, Dr. Davis, what kind of things are you seeing in this survey?
Well, we certainly don't have time to go over all the responses, obviously, in great detail. But let me just point out some of the more interesting results obtained to date. Again, out of the over 2,200 subjects who claim to have conscious recall of their interaction with non-human entities, either in their home or on board a so-called UFO, 93% of these individuals believe that these non-human intelligent beings are from another planet or dimension and that they are already among us. And 84% believe that they've had some kind of communication with them. In fact, the kind of communication that they all say is nonverbal or telepathic. In terms of describing the type of entities, they report, maybe somewhat surprisingly, that the most common entity observed is human-looking, not identical to you or I, but having being very, very similar. I think we tend to use the term Nordics, I think, to refer to that type of being. But we, hear about the short grays. That's next in line in terms of frequency of incidents and contact. But then you have the whole range of insectoids, reptilians, spirit or ghost-like beings represent about 35% of them, where humanoid or Nordic types represented over 50%. The short grays came in second place, 51%. But 43% of these individuals say they recall being on an ET craft, and the vast majority say they have had some, again, contact with non-humans aboard this craft. What's especially interesting is that over 90% feel that the ETs have some type of grand plan. And when we analyze the data, what that grand plan may be is certainly up for speculation, but we continually hear them report themes that address consciousness, spirituality, oneness with the universe, that we're all interconnected, including them and us, and become more environmentally sensitive. Love, I hate to use the term from the Beatles song, but love is the answer. Expressions of love are fostered considerably in their communication. And it seems if we want to get some hints into whether or not this phenomenon, for one, is real, and I do believe it's real, it could very well be in the mind of all of these individuals, or we are in fact being visited by ETs, and I tend to lean in that direction. Nevertheless, they get a sense of positive behavioral transformation. They become more loving towards humanity. At least over 74% said that they've had significant positive change in that respect. Over 70% say they're more environmentally sensitive. They're less materialistic. They become much more spiritual. We're talking over 70% of the respondents are saying this permanently. So as a basis or as a symptom, shall we say, of their experience, less materialistic, more spiritual, less religious. They're not into organized religion, but more, again, more spiritual. Numerous kinds of positive changes of this type, becoming more human. What insight do we get? Well, we could take it the next step and consider the possibility that maybe if this is indeed happening, and I'm not saying 100% for sure that it is, but it is a phenomenon of some type where more research must be directed instead of Roswell, Aztec, New Mexico, et cetera, et cetera. You know what I mean? More research must focus on the phenomenological, experiential types of experiences people are reporting to have. So what is the possible grand plan or purpose here? If there is one, it may very well be that they are transforming individuals one by one, maybe over time, who knows how long, the consciousness or spirituality of this population here on this planet will be transformed for the better. When you go on the internet and you read the books about UFOs, oftentimes you find that it's a negative experience that people have. It's a very painful medical procedures that are performed. They take sperm and eggs, they stick needles in your left, right, and etc. There's some hints of that, people claim, but much less so than what the media and ufologists contend based on their research. Over 90% do not, let me emphasize this again, please, over 90% of the 2,200 individuals report that they do not want their experiences with these ETs, and I hate that term, to end. They want it to continue. Yes, initially, in the first contact, of course, it's a very fearful experience, without question. Whether they see these little beings of various types in their bedroom, and again, they come in all forms, shapes, and sizes, or they're abducted with missing time and they find themselves on board a sterile-like craft somewhere, they report repeated, shall we say, abductions, bad term, and I hate the term ET as well, but non-humans, let's refer to as that, over time, and again, over 50% say that they've been abducted over 10 times. They do not want their experience to end, which is quite remarkable. Maybe there's some type of adaptation process occurring here, like the Stockholm syndrome, when people do become abducted or not. They just feel that they spiritually have grown. They become more, again, conscious. They feel that as if they understand everything. They feel at one with the universe. We're talking about, when I read about their experience and I review their statements and I'm in the process along with others analyzing it, it's hard to use language that we are commonly familiar with to really get at the heart of the meaning that they are sensing or coming away with based on their experience. But the main thing is that it is a positive transformative process, whatever it might be. And it may very well be non-humans from another solar system, dimension, future, who knows? It may not even been happening at all. But whatever is causing it, and maybe it is non-humans from somewhere, keep it up. Because it seems, based on at least our sample size, it is resulting in a very pronounced positive effect.
You know, the thing is that I think that people get a little fixated, and understandably so, on the not so pleasant experiences. You think about things of probing, and maybe to some extent, now this is a lot of it's pop culture, and then some people claim it, you know, various like sexual examination, incredible terror. What did the study, or what do you all have to say about those negative experiences?
A small percentage do consider it to be a horrendous experience. But here again, we're talking about a very small subset. Less than 10% perceive it to be negative. If it was happened to me, I would consider it a violation of my privacy, certainly. They're intruding in my thoughts because they reportedly are communicating with us telepathically. So, but the vast majority initially say, yes, it is a very fearful experience. No doubt it would be to anybody. But when it occurs repeatedly over time, they realize, again, as I mentioned earlier, the positive aspect. But nevertheless, even those who are reporting to have been taken or interacted with numerous times, there are still some that say it's a negative experience. It's a violation of my privacy. They're telling me to do things I don't want to do. I don't have free will, in other words. So it is not 100% positive, but the vast majority, like I said earlier, over 90% say they don't want it to end. That's how beneficial it is. But it seems to take time before they derive that kind of positive effect from these experiences. But many, interestingly, also no longer fear death. Here we're talking about over 80% believe in life after death, reincarnation. And what's also very interesting is that many of the positive transformative effects that I've shared with you, and there are many others, are commonly reported by individuals who have near-death experiences, mm-hmm. almost to a T. And I don't want to review what I had said, but they are shared. It seems beyond coincidence. And is there a relationship? That remains to be decided upon. But that's why, again, if there's an important message here, other than what I've already said, for whatever that might mean to your listeners, research must shift within ufology. It's considered a pseudoscience, and I understand why, coming from a science background. And especially since we've evolved very little, if any, throughout the decades of study in this very unique, enigmatic, field, we have to shift focus. There are way too many ufologists out there that are still stuck in the past, continuing to determine whether or not a UFO event was valid, or the evidence is reliable, or the MJ documents are real. I've had enough of that. You know, I just spoke with Grant Cameron, a very well-known leading.
Yes,
and I enjoyed your interview with him. You do a wonderful job for many reasons, Grant is he's a wealth of information, and he's in the top three, shall we say, of all ufologists out there in terms of contributions. Why I mention him is he will be working with this Dr. Edgar Mitchell Foundation. He sees the importance of our mission to, shift focus from nuts and bolts to trying to better understand the kinds of experiences people are reporting when they have these kinds of interactions with non-humans. He is convinced it is happening. And he's been a nuts and bolts ufologist for decades, since the mid-70s. We need more Grant Camerons, and that's where I'm going here. We need more people who have a name, have a reputation, in ufology, to at least look at our data. And they can, if they go into experiencer.org. That's our website. And they could look at the quantitative results, experiencer.org. And we have many articles on quantum physics, because we do tie this into theories in quantum physics. It doesn't mean that, the answer is there, but there are hints that that certain aspects of quantum physics might explain some of the phenomena we're talking about, like non-locality or telepathy, which we see among humans as well. And it might account for many of the paranormal anomalous kinds of events we have experienced forever in the form of NDEs and apparitions, ESP, you name it, past life recall. There might be an underlying foundation for all of this. Or not, but at least we need to look at that possibility, because we're seeing hints of that in the kinds of reports that people are providing to us that border on this non-locality, on this anomalous kind of events that we see in other related experiences like NDEs, like past life recalls, clairvoyance, telepathy, et cetera, et cetera. So I strongly encourage your listeners who may be interested to look at the quantitative results and to keep an open mind. I encourage that above all. Don't buy into what I'm saying 100%. Look at the evidence, interpret it as you see appropriate, and know that the final verdict isn't in. We will continue, as I mentioned, to gather a considerably more data from a large population sample over time and present the results at conferences, certainly scholarly papers, and UFO conferences. But I want to not only educate members of our board, do not only want to educate the public at large. That's an important aspect of it, to bring it home, to say this the phenomenon is happening. We're not saying one and one is equal to two, but it's a real phenomenon that is deemed highly worthy of continued research by the academic community in many different areas, not only quantum physics, but sociology, psychology, biology, neuroscience. It's multidisciplinary. And even if it is a phenomenon in individuals' minds, which at some level it is, but there's more to it than that, as I've shared. Psychologists, sociologists, anthropologists should find that alone to be of considerable interest. And unfortunately, and it boggles my mind, Jim, why more scholars and non-scholars, but scholars who are familiar with research don't get more involved. And obviously the ridicule factor inhibits their need to do so. John Mack, of course, ran into a considerable problem at Harvard University when he was advocating that people were being abducted. And he had a fight for tenure, which he maintained. You're well aware, and I'm sure your listeners are too, for the most part. People are afraid, so to speak, to come out of the closet. Now that I'm retired, I can. I can talk about it. In fact, your listeners can look at my website, theufophenomenon.com. Look at some of my writings. I address this there, as well as my book on UFOs. I'm now writing a book on the afterlife, which ties in a little bit here, because we're looking at a lot of related phenomena, like near-death experiences, of course, from past life recall, mediumship, apparitions. Here again, we see hints of this with the individual's experience with non-humans, how they can materialize and dematerialize, how they feel that there's a paranormal aspect to their experience. Paranormal is a bad word, but anything that defies logic or doesn't ascribe to current traditional scientific concepts, I guess we can call anomalous or paranormal. But these are things that they are saying happens. Over 70% say they can love others in more of an impersonal way than ever before. Relative to before the experience, they're much more sensitive to the suffering of others. They're more concerned with spiritual matters. Well, we're talking here again close to 80% relative to how they were before the experiences began. They understand themselves. 82% say they understand themselves much more strongly than ever before. So there's this self-reflection. There's this, you know, personal perspective of insights in terms of who they are and what the world is all about, what the purpose of life is. 77% that they have a good understanding now of what the purpose in life is, and it does relate, according to them, in the areas of oneness, love, spirituality, consciousness. And if I can use a term that continually comes up as the message, it's that consciousness. I think that's the underlying essence of the phenomenon. We're just scratching the surface understanding this phenomenon, but the key may be in that area. And quantum physics certainly addresses that. You go back into the behavior of subatomic particles and the observer effect and how these electrons and photons behave differently based on whether or not they're being observed. Well, we could spend hours talking about that, but it's a real effect, and Einstein considered it as spooky action at a distance. I'm sure right. you're familiar with this, yeah. Jim. You've had many leading scientists on your show, and we still don't understand it. But the key is, our brain also is composed of these mysterious subatomic particles that operate in such strange, enigmatic ways. So maybe that also potentially governs our behavior. Maybe that allows for some people to demonstrate ESP, remote viewing, telepathy, etc. Or maybe consciousness is not the brain. That's the essence of maybe what life is all about. Is there life after death? In other words, does the brain produce consciousness, or does consciousness continue after bodily death? We all would love to know that. But here again, we're getting some insights based on the individuals who are reporting experiences with non-humans. Why they are, I don't know, but they are. And in such the large majority are out of such a large data set. And I'm most curious to see if that continues as we continue to collect data from many other thousands of individuals worldwide. You know, I don't think it's a psychocultural effect here. It's not a delusional effect either. We do get into those issues of mental illness and as best as we can. And obviously, many will criticize our research for not controlling for that variable as well. Somebody may say, well, they're all psychotic. Well, I don't think all 2,200 plus are. Certainly a subset may very well be, and making it up for whatever reason. But we're talking numbers, and that adds to the validity of my message. I don't have an answer. I'm simply relaying some very interesting data. Other greater minds, your listeners, etc., are the ones to make the determination as to what it might potentially mean. And to have the answer is certainly premature. There is no answer at this point in time, at least. It's going to take a considerable amount of time to figure out what really is going on. But all I can say with certainty is this, Jim. Something profound is going on, and the ufology community must stop. And I shouldn't dictate, because let's shift research focus. Continue to analyze Roswell if you wish, and Aztec and Rendlesham. We learn from it. It's interesting. Yes, it's important. And I commend those and those organizations that are involved in that type of research activity. I commend you greatly. But there is considerable room for a shift in research focus to what I'm sharing. And this must be emphasized within ufology if we are ever to get some credibility within mainstream science and to actually turn on a lot of the scholars within academia to also do research in this area. And we have some, you know, Gary Schwartz from Yale, who does a lot of work with afterlife experiments, among many others. But the point is, we don't have enough contributions from scholars.
Do you think that's going to change?
You know, it's hard to say. I if it's going to change slowly, I think maybe what our results will help facilitate some of that change. Obviously, not overnight. 100 years from now, yeah, more will be certainly on board. We'll have certainly new scientific principles that may help us better understand what is happening here, as well as other phenomena which we've addressed. It will change. It can't get any worse, and I can't believe how much disarray ufology is in right now. I hate to use the term joke. That's not appropriate, really. But we're not going to get anywhere understanding the essence of the UFO phenomenon, which again is real, if we continue to do what we're doing. And that's why I'm not doing that. And I did write a book called "The UFO Phenomenon: mm-hmm. Should I Believe?" I think readers might find that somewhat interesting. I'm writing a book on the afterlife, which also ties all of this in. UFOs is not a unique phenomenon in that it stands alone. It is very unique, very important, and it might very well be the key to understanding what we are all about and our potential in terms of consciousness. And how we should behave, maybe as well. The implications are guesswork at this point, but ufology has to shift direction, as I said for the third time, and I feel so strongly with that, and I'm so glad people like Grant Cameron are on board. I emphasize to your listeners to listen to him speak, Grant Cameron, on YouTube, listen to your interview with him. Mary Rodwell, if I may add sure. A plug. Mary Rodwell, a researcher in this area in Australia. Her website is acern.org. She is a member of our Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Experiences. I think she has the answers. We don't have the answer, okay? But I think she has key insights based on her research with thousands of individuals who also claim to have these kinds of experiences. She's way beyond the average, shall we say, ufologist. And I resonate with her. And it's a pleasure knowing her. I've learned a great deal from her. And there are other types like this of Mary Rodwell's. But I strongly urge your listeners to listen to her on YouTube, Mary Rodwell, R-O-D-W-E-L-L. And I talk about on my website, Ray Hernandez, one of the members of our organization on the board of directors. He's the heart and the soul behind this, as well as Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the late Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth person to walk on the moon. He's also the director of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Brilliant individual. It was a pleasure to know him for a brief period of time, as I did. But he ascribes to this, as well as many other leading physicists, again, like Rudy Shield, like Stephen Hawking and Kaku and Green and on, who ascribe to theories in quantum physics, alternate realities, the multiverse, possible existence of other dimensions where beings coexist with our reality. If they are right, they all ascribe to it. And if they are right, maybe we are accessing that dimension, or these individuals are, involuntarily, it seems. But some people report to do it voluntarily. Some people report that ayahuasca brings them there, or near-death experience brings them there, or lucid dreaming, meditation. There are many possible ways to access that other realm.
Now, let me ask you this, and then by all means, please finish your thought. If somebody has experienced something like this and they want to be a part of this study, can they, and how can they? And then, of course, finish your thought as well. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, no, not at all, Jim. I appreciate that question. And again, I appreciate all of your contributions in this and other related areas. So we need more people like you in this field. Individuals who do believe that they are having these kinds of experiences can go on our website, experiencer.org, and look at our survey. They can take the survey. and become part of the study. They could also contact me through my website, and I'd be more than happy to communicate with them about their experience and maybe give them some direction if needed as to what that experience might mean. Again, not that I have the answers, but people do have these experiences, and there's many, many thousands of them out there, if not way more than that, who are confused, who have this, who hide from it, who do not share it for obvious reasons with others, and have no place to go. Our foundation not only is conducting research, as we have discussed, but also is providing support mechanisms for those who need the opportunity to communicate, to receive some counsel from people who are in this field, like a Mary Rodwell, among others, who can say, it's okay to talk about it. You know, you're not alone. That kind of thing. And Grant Cameron has a similar type of support group in Canada, and we are hooking up with him. And make this a worldwide based kind of support group, but also educate. There's an educational component to it. We're in the process of developing a documentary, and we hope to eventually have it run on TV, some show here again to educate humanity, to tell people that. You know, there's more than just Ancient Aliens and that show, which is interesting. It's good. I'm not criticizing it, but this, I think, stands above all as the key essential component to this phenomenon, and maybe many related phenomenon, at least that deserves greater research attention.
All right. Well, Dr. Robert Davis, thank you so much. Congratulations on your research and continued success. And I hope that you learn a lot of things that you can share with us in the future. And as you have updates, you're welcome back on the program to tell us the latest and greatest.
Well, thank you again, Jim, for inviting me to appear on your show. And it's a pleasure speaking with you again. I look forward to doing so in the future, too. Thank you.
Another amazing conversation. Had a great week, I thought, a great show, and I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. I hope that you'll tell your friends. I hope you'll check out all the things we told you about. Of course, check out our friends over at Scotty Vest, our friends over at Club W. Check out the adult coloring book of True Ghost Stories. Really, that's a lot of fun. And I hope you'll continue to check out all of my podcasts, and please tell your friends. We'll talk to you next time on the Paranormal Podcast. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.